Tony Bennett and Bill Evans, and my very special guest is Tony Bennett. He's one of the greatest interpreters of American popular songs, and his recordings and his television appearances have given me enormous pleasure, and I know that that's something I share in common with millions of Americans. Tony Bennett will be performing at Valley Forge Music Fair with the Count Basie Orchestra next week, November 22nd through 28th. Tony Bennett, it's really a thrill to meet you, and I'm glad you're here. Thank you for being here.
It's a great pleasure for me to be here because your network, you know, really kind of saves my whole spirit and feelings on the road. You know, getting away from New York City, you just say, oh, my God, I'm going away from wisdom and education. And it's so great to listen to a station that has so many interesting different aspects of and different ways of education. And it's an enlightening station for me.
Well, it makes me very happy that you listen to public stations. What makes a song right for you to sing? I mean, you have a wonderful repertoire, and your interpretation of certain songs have really made me hear them in a way I haven't before. How do you know that a song is one that you want to sing? What do you look for?
Well, it's something I've experienced. Sometimes I just migrate over to like what's autobiographical unconsciously. I'll just find something and I say, my God, I've experienced that. I've lived that. It's happened to me. And it could be humorous. It could be, dramatic. It could be smooth and cool. You never know which way it's going to come from. But what I really look for is a kind of craftsmanship in a song, someone who's really musically knowledgeable and combines it with great words so that it meshes. And I like to concentrate on interpretation, on interpreting songs.
I think in the 1960s when the music business started to really be taken over by rock music, that it was probably very difficult to record standards, Rodgers and Hart or Gershwin, Cole Porter. You were, I think, with Columbia Records
right. At
that time. And having read Clive Davis's book, I got the impression that he really tried very hard to talk you into recording cover versions of pop and rock tunes of the time.
Yeah, but it's hard to cover Janis Joplin. You know, but it really got that silly, okay? It got that stupid, and I just had to say, look, I'm going to take a break because I was there 23 years, and I was always kept the company in the black. I have a way of sensing whether a song is a potential hit. So about three times a year, I would actually be money in the bank for CBS. Guarantee them three standards a year that they could help their whole company by just one record that the public would go in and try and buy, and then they could sell them other things. And they didn't appreciate it. I mean, it's a strange era, you know. I grew up when I first started with CBS, following Billie Holiday in the studio, and in those days there was a certain craftsmanship about recording four songs on a session, And you'd come out with a lot of material. Things would happen. And then in the 50s and early 60s, they started changing the whole philosophy and making obsolescent records, you know, records that could be replaced next week by something else. And the premise of making a performance to last forever was gone. They just tried to sell on impulse. They got very enamored with computers and instead of listening to what the public wanted, they changed their whole system and they said, let's just give the public what we want and just saturate it. And this famous word marketing came into being, where they just market and blanket an area with so much money and so much promotion that the public senses that that's the only thing that's popular, even though it isn't. So it's kind of a false popularity. And it's, luckily enough, right now it's breaking down. It's stopping. You know, it's back to the old cliche, you can fool the people some of the time, but not all of the time. I noticed in the recent political polls that started to happen, you know, where millions of dollars were put into certain people and they didn't come in. So the public is finally getting wise to the fact that they're being taken and they're starting to read between the lines. And it's very encouraging now.
Were you told that in order to stay current, that you'd better cover the current pop tunes?
Well, yes, but then they started, you know, even if I had a good suggestion, they kind of just moved me out. They just kind of, you know, in other words, I can't take it personal. They did it with everyone. It's kind of a supermarket instead of a grocery store, you know. They just collected many artists, and when they had enough material on all the artists, they go to the next, and hoping for another Beatles or, you know, something big to happen, and that would kind of wipe up all the investment they made on all the other artists.
I should imagine that it's difficult to keep your bearings in situations like that when everybody's telling you to record cover versions. Did you always have faith that if you stuck to the material that you really liked and had a strong feeling for and felt was your material, that things would work out even if there were a couple of tough years?
Yes, I had great support from the public. I believed in word of mouth many years ago, even when Columbia was really putting me in focus. I still believe that if you did a good show in Akron, Columbus would hear about it right away in the next town and the next town. And I've watched it for years, and sure enough, my instincts were right. The public has supported me. Now, fortunately, John Hammond has given me a contract, of all things, on CBS again. I'll be recording again, and with a very big budgeted album. And so it's been a 9-year hiatus that's gave me a lot of time to think, and also things work out for the best. It taught me a lot about performing. I didn't have to come up with the next hit every 3 or 4 months. And this way I was able to just concentrate on the public, entertaining the public, giving them a good show, and not have the pressure of trying to plug something new. I was able to just be natural on stage, and it taught me a lot. And I think now, going back into recording, combining the show business aspect of it and with the fact that I know how to record popular music, I think it's going to be a good combination. I'm looking forward to recording again.
Who are you going to be recording with?
CBS, John Hammond, and it'll be Tori Zito's orchestra.
Let's listen to another one of your recordings. And you'll be performing with the Count Basie Orchestra in Philadelphia next week. And we're going to hear a recording that you made with the Basie Orchestra in, I'm actually not sure what year this is from. Perhaps you recall.
I think it was 55.
We're going to hear your recording of Chicago. Can I ask you what attracted you to this song?
It was Philadelphia. Actually, yeah, it was at the with Dave Dushoff's, you know, Latin Casino. And that's the first time Basie and I had ever gotten together. I think it was the first time a singer ever got together with Basie. And we covered all kind of tunes. And this is a very special album because it was unforgettable. We recorded it starting at 12 o'clock at night, and we finished at 8 in the morning. We did the whole album in one night. So it was really something that's unforgettable. I remember the feeling of it, the whole, how relaxed Basie was when he came in and just played his inimitable way, and something that I treasure personally.
Well, I really love this record. Let's
thank you.
Let's hear Tony Bennett's recording with the Count Basie Band of Chicago.
Toddling town, Chicago, Chicago, I'll show you around. Bet your bottom dollar you lose the blues in Chicago, Chicago, the town that Marty Faye could not shut down. On State Street, that great street, I just want to say they do things that they don't do on Broadway. Say they have the time of their life. I saw a man, he danced with his wife in Chicago. Hometown.
the time of their life. I saw a man, he danced with his wife in Chicago.
From the mid-1950s, Tony Bennett with the Count Basie Orchestra. Is there any etiquette amongst singers about who records what tune? And, like, could anyone record I Left My Heart in San Francisco after you recorded it? How many years did it take until someone was able to make a recording of that?
Well, see, in the early 50s, when I recorded, there was still a semblance of ethics, you know, because if Nat Cold had a recording, you just left it alone. You found your own, and it was quite a challenge because he'd come up with some pretty good records. So you'd have to really find something that would be a little different than his. And then back into the 60s, like we're talking about, they started marketing so much, they insisted that everyone just record. They broke the game up, you know. In other words, when they took it out of the hands of the creative, it got into accountants and agents and lawyers, and they made the decisions, the board meetings, you know, instead of individuals. Originally, it was like Goddard Liebeson and Mitch Miller and Percy Faith and Frank Duvall, wonderful musicians that understood the music business. And the way it is now, it's all set up where there's not one musician that's a producer at CBS. There's not one. They're all in the economical end of the business. So their suggestions are far from creative, and they kind of shoot down any creative ideas.
So what are the ethics among singers?
Well, there used to be great ones. I mean, if you whoever had a song, they just left it alone, and that was your song. But today, everybody covers everybody else, and it's really kind of silly. And to me, it's diluted the whole essence of a proper star system. Of you know, if K-Star had a hit years ago, that was her hit, you know. And if Nat had one, or Basie had one, that was his, you know. And today, if a song comes out that sounds nice, 12 artists record it with very little imagination and kind of imitate the original record. So they all kind of sound alike. And it shouldn't be that way. I mean, it should get back to the public being the judge, being the critic. The public should be the critic. You know, if they like something, you could hear it in their applause. And then the producers should just hire the people that the public's applauding for. It would be a lot more fun.
If one looks to see what other people are recording and there's certain songs you don't touch, the only person I think now who would be in the same league with you would be Sinatra. Would you be paying attention to what other people were recording and seeing what was theirs?
Well, hey, you know, it's if someone comes up with a nice song this and you feel you could do, to me there is a game, and the game is to make it your own number somehow, even if you have to change the tempo a little.
Right.
If Sinatra's doing a tune that's a ballad but you like it very much, you could swing it. Or if there's a swing tune that you could turn into a ballad, so that it becomes your interpretation, your way of doing it. So there's a little originality. I'm very interested in people that are individuals rather than all doing the same thing.
You've sung with big bands like Basie's, and you've sung in small settings like with Bill Evans. Do you find yourself singing differently, phrasing differently in different settings like that?
Yes, and it's all according to good performers. I mean, if they, whether it be a symphony, a philharmonic orchestra, or a single piano player like Bill Evans, as long as they're great musicians, I mean, by great musicians, I mean good performers, then, I respond to that. And that's the only way that a record is alive. I mean, you know, it's like Sir Robert Morley told me one time that Shakespeare would be dead without the right performers. And there's a lot of truth to that. There's a great minimization of interpreters. But to me, interpreters make songs live. Judy Garland, Frank Sinatra, Nat King Cole, they interpreted. Today we're kind of bent on the fact that popular musicians should also compose their own songs. Well, that's very ambitious, but there's only a few Charlie Chaplins around, and there's only a few Cole Porters around. And I'd hate to match my talent against theirs when it comes to the craftsmanship of writing a song. So I put my energy on interpreting the music, American music, and try to do what the composer has in mind.
Is your song style something you feel you've like worked on like consciously, or is it so intuitive that you've just let it happen?
Well, I've had a very, a couple of very, very good teachers. You know, really, my high school teacher talked me into the music business, Mr. Sonberg of High School of Industrial Art. I was going there to paint and study painting, but he was into Art Tatum and got me interested in popular music. And then I had Miriam Spear, who was right on 52nd Street and taught singers like Ella Mae Moss and Peggy Lee. And she was a wonderful coach of popular music. And then I had a nice bel canto teacher that taught me breathing and placement of voice by the name of Pietro Di Andrea, who was a nice opera teacher for voice production. So, and then Tony Tamburello, who's been my coach for the last 30 years now. And so I've been handled by experts right through the years. I've gone to the best teachers that I could dream of. There's a gentleman by the name of Fred Katz, who's a great teacher, who's a cellist, plays jazz cello. And he had a lot to do with helping me out.
Would you ever want to teach? Do you teach?
I try to teach by my actions. It's a hard game, but I try to do that. I try to do it by not compromising, so that when I do show up, there is a tasty musical evening, and then just maybe that might give someone else an idea of that level. But I dislike kind of teaching a classroom. I like a one-to-one teacher. That's why I like radio so much, kind of a one-to-one thing.
Your singing is frequently very behind the beat, and I wonder if that ever throws off, say, a TV studio orchestra that you're playing with who's not really used to working with you.
Well, I have a good trio. Wonderful guys, Ralph Sharon and John Burr on the bass, and Joe LaBarbera, who used to play with Bill Evans. John Burr played with Stan Getz and Buddy Rich, Horace Silva. So they're very oriented to work with me and listen to me. They kind of save the day for me. You know, they'll make sure that it works. They show up and they know just what I like, and they go along with my timing and my feeling.
So you never have to worry anymore about walking into a place with a strange band who's not going to really understand what it is you want.
Mm-hmm. Yes, no, they make it very comfortable, and they're very consistent. No matter, they are also very flexible. No matter what the situation is, they have enough determination to make each situation work, and they're terrific. I mean, I love these guys, and they've been with me quite a while now.
I'd like to play a selection from the first album you recorded with Bill Evans. We'll Be Together Again. That's what we're going to hear. How did this album come to be?
Well, the great jazz singer Annie Ross is a dear friend of mine, and she suggested it. She was the one who said, do an album with Bill Evans. And Bill and I met one another in London at Ronnie Scott's club. And we just started talking about it, thinking about it. And then his manager, Helen Keane, took over from there and kept encouraging me to do the album with Bill. And we made two albums and one television show up in Canada that no one's seen yet, but they will eventually, you know. And it was a very happy experience because he told me to keep, you know, all popular artists have a lot of cronies around them. And he said, keep all the cronies home. He said, and just let's you and I go up to San Francisco and for 3 or 4 days just record an album. And it was such a terrific experience because he's the kind of guy, just my own ears kind of gravitate toward Maurice Ravel or Bill Evans, and I could listen to them all day without feeling like I was overfed or anything, or that I'd want to change it. I could put his music on, just his piano playing, and listen to it all day, and I find it very peaceful and very very good for solitude and thinking of creative ideas. I hear Bill Evans, and I just my mind just triggers off into a creative process. I like it very much.
Did you have to talk about each other's music much before you started to actually play together? Were there any things that you really had to work out?
Well, we had an admiration society going. He liked the way I sang. I loved the way he played. And then we, the only kind of conversations we had about that were just what songs we both agreed that we liked very much. And then he would work for 2 or 3 hours in the studio on the production of a number. And we'd sketch it out. Let's start here. Let's do this surprise. Or let's blend over here. And then after 2 or 3 hours, when we felt we had a kind of a production on a number, we said, let's try one. And we do that for 3 days. We did that for 3 days on both albums. And it was a wonderful thing because it was just the engineer and his manager, Helen Keane, who was the producer, and Bill. And that was it was nice and intimate, very relaxed, and a joy to do.
I love the song that we're about to hear, We'll Be Together Again. Mm. Can I ask you why you chose to include this one?
Well, one of the nicest guys I ever met in the music business was Carl Fisher, who was an accompanist for Frankie Lane, who's American Indian, and a wonderful person who met me before I was popular and sat down quite a few days and just played the piano for me to just encourage me to keep singing. And he wrote You've Changed, another great standard. He's a very, very talented man. And that's the reason that I like the song that much, plus the fact that Billie Holiday made it in an album called Lady in Satin. And I'm very influenced by Billie Holiday.
Well, let's hear this recording of We'll Be Together Again with my guest Tony Bennett, singing accompanied by pianist Bill Evans.
Remember, there's always tomorrow. So what if we have to part? We'll be together again. Your kiss, your smile, a memories I'll treasure forever. Try thinking with your heart. We'll be together again. Times when I know you'll be lonesome. Times when I know you'll be sad. Don't let temptation surround you. Don't let the blues make you bad. Someday, some way, we both have a lifetime before us. Parting is not goodbye. We'll be together. someday, some way, we both have a lifetime before us for parting is not goodbye. We'll be together again.
Tony Bennett with Bill Evans. And if you've been waiting for an opportunity to be able to hear Tony Bennett, he will be performing next week in Philadelphia at the Valley Forge Music Fair.
You know, you failed to mention that not only Count Basie will be there, but also Rosemary Clooney, who's a wonderful singer.
Yeah, she's been recording again, too.
Yeah, she's with Concord, and she just made a beautiful new Cole Porter album. Mm.
Can I ask you something? Do you like your voice?
Yes.
Good.
But I happen to like myself, but I'm not in love with myself. I like myself. No, I'm, you know, but...
I know it sounds foolish to ask if you like your voice, but I just know so many musicians who really can't listen back to their stuff, and they might like what they do.
Amazing. Bill always felt like he was never getting it. I mean, it was very frustrating for me, all this magnificent music. I just listened to those last few bars that he just played on this recording we just listened to, and it's so magnificent in its solidity and its form and the way he played and the feeling. He had a tremendous musician, and he always felt, many times, he just, first of all, he was very careful about his pianos. If the piano just didn't have the right touch, he was just really bugged all day long when he was playing. He felt nothing was happening, and he'd get very annoyed with the piano. But if it was a good piano, he would like it. But then a lot of times he felt that he wasn't getting it. And I know that, I understand that feeling, and that's happened to me. A lot of times I've recorded... And I think the trouble is that what happens is sometimes you work too hard. I heard right on the public radio the other day, Ray Bradbury, the science fiction writer, and he was saying the importance of, and it was very educational for me personally, because he said, if you have a problem, if you have a project that you're working on, rather than looking at it like a monster, you know, just take it and realize that, okay, there's a problem there, but... Don't ponder on it, you know. Don't really lean on it too heavy. Just go out, you know, he said, play tennis, have sex, just do your life, you just do what you have to do, and then get back to it, you know. Just don't let that become all-consuming. And I think it's very right, especially for creative people. I also read once in Matisse on Art that he said the same thing, that the minute you don't feel like painting, just put your brush down and stop. And when you do feel it, then drop everything and then really go into it when you do feel it. But if you don't feel it, he said, stop. Now, everyone's different. Other people feel like, well, I like the discipline of playing, you know, just going, you know, doing a little every day. Like Balzac wrote that way, you know, he just wrote in a regimented fashion and it came out anyway. So there's no one way, you know. Art is as incongruous as nature. There's no rules. Each person has to find their own comfort. But I thought that was a good suggestion that Ray made about just touching lightly on things rather than overburdening your mind.
Can you tell when you record something if it's going to be a hit or not?
I've been very lucky that way. I know a lot of people say that no one knows whether a song is a hit or not, but I have a feel that's kind of similar to the public. Just recently, Ralph Sharon, my music director, reminded me or showed me a piece in the L.A. Times where he had the public choose 20 of their favorite songs. And out of the 20, I was doing 17 in my act. I kind of gravitate to what the public likes. I don't do it intentionally. I just like what they like. And I believe in melody. I love the melodic line, and I think the majority of the public likes that. And I happen to like popular music, what Noel Coward called little cheap songs.
Did you know that I Left My Heart in San Francisco would be the overwhelming smash success that it was?
I had no idea about that one, because I really thought that was a local hit, that in San Francisco the people loved their magnificent city, and I thought it would just be local in that area. having no idea it would ever break into an international song.
What goes through your mind when you sing it now?
I happen to like it very much. It's a, you know, I had a great idol in, when I was younger, and even now, Maurice Chevalier, the way he performed, his gregariousness, his spirit, his energy at his old age was something to behold. And he had a handle called Paris, and everything he sang about was Paris. And to me, you know, it's, San Francisco is America's Paris. So it's a wonderful song for people to dream by. A lot of times they said it doesn't necessarily mean San Francisco to them, just something, some dream that they'd like to have happen. And it happens to have a nice musical structure to it, and I like the song, so I don't mind doing it. I have to do it wherever I play, and a lot of people, a lot of creative people say, don't you get tired of singing that? And I retort by saying to them, do you ever get tired of making love? So it's like that. I happen to love the fact that it's made me this popular. It's allowed me to be as creative as I want in any musical endeavor. So it's given me a great license to be established in an institution in the country, and I'm very grateful for that song.
I think it took me a few years to really appreciate that song. When it was a hit, I was pretty young and kind of categorically rejected a lot of pop mm-hmm. tunes and a lot of standards, and was listening to rock and roll. And as my ears opened up to different kinds of mm-hmm. music, it's such a really beautiful song and a really beautiful beautiful recording. I wonder if you meet a lot of people like that who start hearing you with completely different ears as
the Beatles,
they get a little older and open
the
up.
Whole Beatle group, you know, that grew up with the Beatles. It's very encouraging as to what they're doing right now. I mean, they're all married and settled down. They have children, and now their tastes are changing, and they have a broader look at things. All of a sudden, they're starting to like ballet and classical music and folk music and jazz. There's a big accent on jazz, which they would never have looked at before. It was very close-minded. You know, that era, they were great victims of marketing. You know, everybody was just, that music was shoved down everybody's throat. The public didn't like it. They were just told to like it. And if you were going to be gregarious, you didn't dare go against your group. You know, the whole group said, no, this is our music. And it was kind of, it took it away from public taste. And the marketing guys insisted that we'll shove this down everybody's throat and they'll like it. Well, now they've just gotten too many returns on all the recordings that they made, and they're finding out it worked for a little while, but not now. It's starting to change, and it's getting back to, thank God, to a broader spectrum of more musicality.
Do you find that you do a different kind of performance in a more showbiz setting than you would, say, in a jazz club? And do the audiences respond to different kinds of material in those different settings?
I like to experiment, so therefore I like being flexible. I like studying flexibility. I like going from a piano player as wonderful as Bill Evans up to a Philharmonic Orchestra. I did a television special this season with Buddy Rich on the BBC that'll be played in America, and you'll see it's primarily drums and voice. So I like to experiment. I like changing my... I don't like being predictable, and I like to do different things and try and... I was the first one to put screens behind me and have film behind me, and... Things I was the first one to sing without a microphone in clubs, you know, and a lot of times. So I'll try things, and if they work, I leave them in.
When you're using a microphone, which hand do you hold it in?
The left hand.
How come?
I don't know. I guess I my Italian heritage, my right hand goes automatically in to explain myself.
So is that why you think your right hand moves?
I think so. Hey, Gisadich.
Do you go back to your old neighborhood much in Queens?
Oh, yes, Astoria. I'm the Astoria kid. I love the area because it's only about 15 minutes away from New York City, and it has a country attitude, funny enough.
Astoria?
It's like a Midwest town, and it's away from the city. By the way, the view from Astoria of Manhattan is absolutely the best view of New York City. You see the Empire State, the Chrysler Building, the World Trade Center, You see the East River, you see the Triborough Bridge, the Hellgate Bridge, and you get a view looking back at the city that you don't get anywhere else in New York City.
There are a lot of stories about you in the neighborhood, apocryphal stories about those things that you did when you were young and you lived there.
Yes. I played in a lot of clubs there. I was a singing waiter, and I played in a lot of clubs, and that's where I met Al Cohn and Zoot Sims, and they'd come over to Astoria, Queens, and play jazz. And I met these great jazz artists then and had no idea. They were just nice guys. I had no idea they were very famous musicians at the time. And there was a lot of stories. Jimmy Breslin's a great friend of mine. We had many a brew under the L train on Ditmars Boulevard. And he's a grand guy. And a lot of people, Judy Garland came from there, Ethel Merman.
Do you think the stories about you, though, that people living there now tell each other about the things that you did when you lived there?
Well, it hasn't really changed that much. It's a great little town, actually. It's about the best place for moderate-income families to live because you have the kind of neighbors that will talk to you if you feel like talking, and if you really want to be by yourself, they'll leave you alone. It's really one of the nicest places in New York City to live.
Where are you living now?
I live in New York City.
Right. You paint, too. Mm-hmm. And when did you start doing that?
I've been painting my whole life, along with my music. I've been singing and painting my whole life.
You paint under your
Benedetto,
given name.
Yes.
Which is Anthony Benedetto?
Yes, that's what it is.
How come you paint with that name and sing with Tony Bennett?
Well, I just had so many Italians of Italian origin, you know, first-generation Italians, you know, that would bawl me out for changing my name. They got embarrassed. They said, what did you change your name? Were you embarrassed about being an Italian? I said, no. They said, well, so they had no idea that in show business in those days, you needed kind of a name that would be remembered, you know, and Benedetto just didn't sound like a name, a popular name. But since then, I came up with this device that whenever I painted, I would have two careers going, and when I painted, that would be Benedetto. So in show business, my name is Tony Bennett, and the painting career is Benedetto.
Could a Benedetto go perform in nightclubs today? Is it acceptable at this point to have an ethnic name?
Oh, no, there were people with ethnic names then. It was just the current fashion in those days. I mean, everybody changed their name in those days, you know, everyone. Now it's more natural. I think it's all according to what direction you're taking. You can't say, well, if you had done this, would this have happened? I don't know. I really don't. I just like everything that has happened, and I'd like, you know, it's if I had to do it all over again, I'd do it because I like where I landed and I like what I'm doing now.
Do you miss those variety shows on TV, like the Ed Sullivan Show, mm-hmm. where performers could get on and do mm-hmm. a few numbers?
Yeah, definitely. It's just that the once again we're victims of the accountants. You know, they don't want to. They don't mind getting $65,000 for a commercial, but they don't want to pay any money. So that's why you see a barrage of rock, because they don't. You know, the stations don't pay for that. The record companies will give them that film footage free, or put them on a show free just for the promotion of things. But if you want to see Count Basie or Rosemary Clooney or Tony Bennett or Frank Sinatra, you know, the big networks have to really pay for it. That's why you just see them occasionally. That's why radio is so great, because you can see more, hear more stars on radio through recordings.
You have a very distinctive face. Did anyone ever try to convince you that you should look like a, you know, perfect kind of mannequin mm-hmm. Ken doll, you know, like really? As in Ken and Barbie in order to really make it?
For many years, yes, for many years. It was a lot tougher years ago, you know. Boy, I didn't look like a singer at all. Now they say I'm a prototype of a singer, but I don't get it. I mean, but they've actually guessed wrong right down the line. It's interesting that there's a certain creative people have it, and the uncreative really can't tell who the creative are. It's interesting to me, you know, because, you know, they told Sinatra he was too skinny and that Durante should get a nose job, and you know, and Clark Gable, his ears were too big. You know, they hear all these stories. They said, I saw the screen test review of Fred Astaire's screen test. They said he's thin and he's balding, and he dances a little. That was their review of Fred Astaire. So that's why I believe in the public. The public and mass are kind of, as a group, they kind of have a touch of genius. They, you know, you see them get highly excited. You say, what's happening? And all of a sudden they say they like that guy. There's something about the whole audience that likes that one individual performer. The audience is the critic. The audience is the judge. No matter how intellectually involved we get with computers, it's never going to, you'll never get away from the soul or the human touch of things, the feeling. And when someone like Judy Garland steps out on the stage, the public knows it.
Do you know what you'll be performing next week at Valley Forge?
Excuse me?
Do you know what you'll be performing next week at the Valley Forge Music Fair?
Well, I'll be singing with my great friend, the boss of popular music, Count Basie, and also a gal who beat me on an amateur contest for Arthur Godfrey's amateur contest, Rosemary Clooney. So we're together again after many years, and it's going to be a treat because these are really nice people to play with.
Well, I'm thrilled you'll be performing in the Delaware Valley, and it's been very wonderful to meet you today. Thanks so
much. You've been
very
wonderful to me. Thank you.
Tony Bennett has been my guest, and if you want to hear him perform, he will be in the Delaware Valley next week from November 22nd through November 28th, and he'll be performing with the Count Basie Orchestra. Rosemary Clooney will also be on the bill. For any more information about these Valley Forge Music Fair concerts, you can call 644-5000. That's 644-5000. And let's listen to some more of Tony Bennett's recordings. First, we're going to hear I Wish I Were in Love Again from an album of Rodgers and Hart songs that he recorded on a label called The Improv that he co-owned. And then we'll hear him with the Count Basie Orchestra again singing I've Grown Accustomed to Her Face. And thanks again for being with us.
Thank you.
You don't know that I felt good when we up and parted. You don't know I knocked on wood, gladly brokenhearted. Worrying is through, I sleep all night, appetite and health restored. You don't know how much I'm bored. The sleepless nights, the daily fights, the quick toboggan when you reach the heights. I miss the kisses and I miss the bites. I wish I were in love again. The broken dates, the endless waits, the lovely loving and the hateful hates, the conversation with the flying plates. I wish I were in love again. No more pain, no more strain. Now I'm sane, but I would rather be Gaga, the pulled out fur of Cat and Kerr, the fine mismating of him and her. I've learned my lesson, but I wish I were in love again. The furtive sigh, the blackened dye, the words I love you till the day I die, the self-deception that believes the lie. I wish I were in love again. When love congeals, it soon reveals the faint aroma of performing seals, the double crossing of a pair of heels. I wish I were in love again. No more care, no despair. Well, I'm all there now, but I'd rather be punch drunk. Believe me, sir, I much prefer the classic battle of him and her. I don't like quiet and I wish I were in love again. I wish I were in love again. I've grown up. accustomed to her face. She almost makes the day begin. I've grown accustomed to the tune. She whistles night and noon. Her smiles, her frowns, her ups, her downs are second nature to me now. Like breathing out and breathing in, I was serenely independent and content before we met. Surely I could always be that way again, and yet I've grown accustomed to her looks, accustomed to her voice, accustomed to her face. I'm very grateful she's a woman and so easy to forget. Rather like a habit one can always break, and yet I've grown accustomed to the trace of something in the air, accustomed to
Tony Bennett with the Count Basie Orchestra, and they'll be performing together next week, November 22nd through 28th, at the Valley Forge Music Fair in Valley Forge. Well, it's 5 minutes after 3 o'clock. This is Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia, 91 FM, and I just want to thank everybody once again for your generosity and support during our fundraiser. And we did very well. It was the best fundraiser that we've ever had on WUHY, so thanks again to all of our listeners. At about 4:25, we'll be beginning a new series produced by Charles Hardy, who also brought you the Popular Culture Show, and this series is called I Remember When, Times Gone But Not Forgotten, and it's a series of oral histories of Philadelphia. With me now is Daniel Ford, the former executive director of the Union of Concerned Scientists. Ford led a 10-year investigation into the nuclear industry, and he gained access to the Atomic Energy Commission's files and found that although they were supposed to be regulating the atomic energy industry, they saw themselves as partners with industry, and reports that were critical of nuclear power or exposed safety hazards were frequently suppressed or downplayed by the AEC. Ford's report is published in a new book. It's called The Cult of the Atom, The Secret Papers of the Atomic Energy Commission. The book is published by Simon & Schuster, and it was also serialized in The New Yorker. Dan Ford, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
Why'd you begin this investigation?
Well, I had started back in 1970 working at the Economic Research Project at Harvard. I'm an economist by training. And we were studying the economics of environmental questions. And we started studying nuclear energy because it looked like a nifty way of meeting the energy needs without all the soot and fly ash and sulfur oxides and other pollutants that accompany conventional power sources. So I started off studying it because it looked important and I had, you know, sort of a positive viewpoint on it.
Well, when you were examining the Atomic Energy Commission, what files did you get access to?
Well, what happened was that right in, I guess it was 1971, I had heard about some tests about emergency cooling systems, one of the basic safety systems, and the system had failed in the tests. And so we started making, the Union of Concerned Scientists, for which I started to work, we started making requests for documents relating to emergency cooling. And you see, our impression at the time was that, the Atomic Energy Commission, in its, haste to build a nuclear program, had perhaps overlooked some of the technical problems. And we thought, these problems should be corrected, and then the nuclear program, could go sailing onward. But the thing that I found to my amazement was that the Atomic Energy Commission hadn't not overlooked these problems, that they had known all about them, that they knew about a very large collection of other safety problems, but that the commission had, repeatedly suppressed all of this unwelcome news. Now, over the last decade, there have been lots of headlines about nuclear power from time to time and controversy, and, the public, sort of gets bits and pieces of information. But the message of, my book is that, you may think you've heard about the problems of nuclear power, but you ain't heard nothing yet. Because what is really involved here, this isn't a scientific book, it's not a technical book, it is a book about the abusive power, the betrayal of the public trust by one of the most powerful federal agencies that was ever created. And it's really a scandal that goes back into the 1950s. When the Atomic Energy Commission was given a report by its chief safety advisors saying that a proposed nuclear plant in Michigan ought not to be built because of its safety problems. The commission suppressed the report. It withheld it from Congress and went ahead and approved the plant anyway. And, of course, the plant then, when it was built, experienced one of the worst accidents that's ever occurred. And there are so many instances which the public just hasn't heard about. Another event, in 1961, an Atomic Energy Commission prototype reactor exploded. And there were all sorts of, official investigations and public reports. And the accident was attributed to a design problem and an operator error, et cetera. But in fact, going through the AEC internal files, I found that the commission internally concluded that this event, which killed the three reactor operators, wasn't an accident. That according to the Atomic Energy Commission memo that I cite in The Cult of the Atom, they said that this event was a result of murder-suicide. That one of the operators had become unstable. He thought that his wife was involved with one of the other operators. And one night when they were on the maintenance shift, when the reactor was supposed to be shut down, he yanked out the main control rod and blew the whole thing up. Now, the AEC didn't make this information public because they were afraid that the people living in the vicinity of other nuclear plants would worry about the risk of sabotage. And in fact, sabotage remains a very serious problem. These plants are not adequately protected against sabotage at all, and they're not adequately protected against a wide range of other, problems that could contribute to catastrophic accidents.
You said that one of the problems with the Atomic Energy Commission is that it saw itself both as an advocator of, but as a regulator of, nuclear power.
Well, it's really the fault of the Congress, you see, because Congress set up the AEC as both promoter and regulator of nuclear power. And, of course, we all recognize that one of the most ingenious features of our constitutional system is this whole idea of checks and balances, that you've got the federal agencies, but Congress oversees them and the courts can oversee both the agencies and Congress. Well, the whole system of checks and balances just didn't work. It broke down. The Congressional Joint Committee on Atomic Energy, it was called, didn't function as the watchdog. Instead, they were more sort of the cheering section for the nuclear program. They just wanted the AEC to go faster, to go faster. They wanted more bombs, more nuclear power. There was no careful independent review. And, of course, the courts did not act as any kind of break on the AEC, because under the law, the courts essentially were uninvolved in reviewing substantive AEC decisions. Those were considered, oh, technical decisions that were beyond the ken of judges. So you had this powerful, mission-oriented agency that just pursued this goal with, you know, just unrestrained fervor, and just the whole program was just really out of control.
Why do you think there was so much fervor? What did the people at the AEC have to gain? Why was so much of their own ego invested in the promotion of nuclear power?
Well, I think, you know, the cult of the atom begins with the story of Glenn Seaborg. He was, you know, a very young chemist at the University of California at Berkeley back in 1939. And, you know, when he heard the news that, you know, atomic fission had been discovered, I mean, he, you know, later recalled how he walked the streets of Berkeley that night for hours and hours, you know, just thinking about the implications of all of this. He then went on himself, and he was the co-discoverer of plutonium, which is the material out of which we make nuclear bombs. And it's also a material that could potentially supply a limitless amount of energy for mankind. And, I mean, Seaborg became obsessed with the idea that here was something that future history would depend on. And here he was in the center of it all. And he became the chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission. And by his own description, he was the nuclear program's number one salesman. And he predicted atomic marvels here and there, atomic-powered flights to the moon, atomic-powered, you know, scuba diving suits. And, you know, he's described, you know, nuclear plants. You know, he says each big nuclear plant surrounded by its own little Eden. And the thing is that the man needed bifocals. I mean, he was a visionary, and he could sort of see off into the distant atomic-powered utopia. But he didn't have any little corrective lens to make him look at the small problems like the nuts and bolts and valves, all the things that determine safety. The AEC's idea was, oh, well, the industry will take care of safety. We will sort of set general requirements for the industry to follow. I mean, rules that say, you know, thou shalt be careful, thou shalt have control rooms. But all the details were left up to the industry. And that